Today, why has Donald Trump chosen Tulsa, Oklahoma, the city that experienced perhaps the worst incident of racial violence in American history, for his first rally since the COVID crisis and the Black Lives Matter protests? I'm going to start with a warning. There are descriptions of violence in this piece, and there is some bad language. There's been a lot of controversy about Donald Trump's plans for his first political rally since the COVID crisis struck. First, the decision itself, to pack thousands into a hall in the middle of a pandemic. Then the timing. Originally set for June the 19th or Juneteenth, when America commemorates the moment that all slaves were finally set free. Faced with anger, Trump pushed back his event by one day to tomorrow. But he did not change another potential flashpoint, the location.
The fact that Donald Trump is holding this rally in Tulsa, Oklahoma, which 99 years ago was the site of one of the worst racist massacres in America in the 20th century, has infuriated lots of people, not just in Tulsa, but all over the country.
From The Guardian, I'm Anushka Astana. Today in Focus, what the history of Tulsa, Oklahoma tells us about race in America today. Ollie, if you were to walk through the Greenwood District in Tulsa 100 years ago, what would you have seen?
So Tulsa is a mid-sized city at the sort of southern tip of America's Midwest.
Oliver Lockland is the Southern Bureau Chief for Guardian US.
And it's really kind of, I would say, just above the borderline between the Deep South and the Midwest. So the Greenwood District of Tulsa was referred to colloquially then as Black Wall Street. It was a thriving community of African Americans. About 10,000 African Americans were living in Tulsa. They had been drawn to Oklahoma because of the oil boom. They'd been drawn away from the Deep South, where racist Jim Crow laws were in more prevalence. Tulsa was still a segregated city at that time. But really, what was going on in Tulsa was quite an extraordinary thing. Greenwood was home to luxury shops. There were 21 restaurants, 30 grocery stores, a hospital, banks, a post office, three hotels, jewelry and clothing stores, two movie theatres, a library, pool halls, a bus and cab service, as well as two black newspapers and six private airplanes. So really, I guess when you think about the experience of black Americans in the 1920s in the Midwest and the South, Tulsa was an exception, really. I spoke to one current Tulsa resident.
My name is Brenda Nails Alford. Do you need my age?
Don't need your age.
A lady named Brenda Alford. She traces her lineage back to that time.
I was born in Chicago, Illinois, but have been here since I was probably a week old. Mm-hmm. So this is my home. My great-uncle Henry and other family members, they were the proud owners of the Nails Brothers Shoe Shop and Record Shop, which was located at 121 North Greenwood Avenue. They also were the first owners of what is now Lacey Park, wherein the Nails Dance Pavilion and Skating Rink was located. They also operated a chauffeur and taxi service.
So they were serious entrepreneurs and serious businessmen.
They were very, very entrepreneurial-minded people, as most people in the community were at that time. They also owned several pieces of property.
The community that existed there was one that had built itself up from scratch.
All of that changed in the early 1920s. Tell me what happened.
At the end of May in 1921, Dick Rowland, a black teenager who worked as a shoe shiner, was trying to go to the bathroom. His employer didn't have bathroom amenities for black people, and so he was forced to use a bathroom in an opposite building. He entered an elevator, which was operated by a white teenager, 17-year-old Sarah Page, and Roland was accused by local white newspapers of either attempting to sexually assault her or sexually assaulting her. And I should just say at this point, Roland was never actually brought to trial and was never found guilty of assaulting anybody. Anyway, this incident led to Roland being arrested by the white police department in the city, and he was held at a local courthouse where a lynch mob kind of came down and demanded that he was handed over to the mob at a time where lynchings were prevalent across Oklahoma and the deep American South. And so this black community, members of that community, turned up at the courthouse demanding that Roland was handed back to the community and demanding that he was released. What eventually happened was a scuffle broke out between the lynch mob and some of the members of the black community who had turned up armed, and it just descended into absolute chaos, where the lynch mob grew and grew, and eventually Green was essentially invaded by hordes of white people who began shooting indiscriminately, torching houses and businesses. And actually, there are reports that airplanes were brought in as well, that people were shooting from airplanes, and some accounts suggesting there was bombings.
Our family ran for safety just like most of the community did. They would come back to find our homes and our businesses looted and burned to the ground. So they pretty much lost everything. Maybe.
And basically, Greenwood was razed to the ground over one particular brutal evening of unrest, where up to 300 people were killed, mostly black.
It was a massacre.
Yeah, it was a complete massacre.
I mean, I didn't know about it. I didn't know about Black Wall Street, and I didn't know about the massacre that occurred in Tulsa. How well is it known in America?
I would say that it kind of disappeared from popular consciousness very soon after it occurred. And this is something I talked to Brenda about.
Well, when I found out, I have to be quite honest, I was very devastated.
She hadn't actually realized, despite the fact that her grandparents were survivors of this awful massacre.
Basically, I did not find out about the race massacre aspect of our family history until 2003, when I received notification from a legal entity here in town that myself and many others were being included in a lawsuit against the city of Oklahoma, Tulsa, regarding reparations for survivors and descendants of survivors of the race riot, as it was called at that time. However, I knew about our family businesses growing up. I just did not know about that aspect of our family history. So therein would begin my journey. I always knew that my grandmother had to hide in a church for some reason, but I didn't know why. And being so young at the time, I did not know the questions to ask.
And really, it wasn't until the mid-1990s where the city set up its own commission to examine the facts of what occurred then.
Tonight, we're going to report a story that will come as news to most Americans as, frankly, it did to us. This country's most violent race riot didn't happen in Newark or Watts or Detroit. It happened in Tulsa, Oklahoma.
You know, up until that point, it was really referred to as a race riot, not a massacre. And so, you know, this commission kind of came about, established the facts, reported in the early 2000s. And even then, I would say it was known about in Oklahoma. It's now very recently been brought onto the education curriculum in Oklahoma schools.
To a spirited debate over new curriculum created to teach Oklahoma students about Tulsa's 1921 race riot.
But it was kind of brought into mass national focus, I would say, very, very recently in the past year. So if you've seen the show Watchmen, that was a HBO drama serial.
People who wear masks are driven by trauma. They're obsessed with justice because of some injustice they suffered.
The whole series is set in Tulsa, and it starts off with an incredibly brutal, but I would say very realistic depiction of the massacre itself.
I have seen that scene and I found it absolutely chilling. And it sounds like it happened, from what you're saying, at a moment in time that was quite significant for African Americans in Tulsa, because it perhaps represented a moment of change, or as you say, a moment of progress. It was almost as if this massacre was a reaction to the idea of black people succeeding. You said that that progress was lost. What do you mean by that? What happened to the black community in the decades that followed?
But this community was actively prevented from bouncing back, I would say. As we mentioned, hundreds of people lost their homes. Many people fled the city. Some people were forced to live in tents for years outside of the city. Every single insurance claim that a black person filed for loss of property during the massacre was rejected by insurance companies. This is something that I spoke to Brenda about.
Their insurance policies, none of that meant anything.
And so really, it crippled the community there.
To have to, you know, lose everything the way they did and not receive any restitution for it, is a situation that was horrible because they lost their economic base and it was never replaced.
In the years after the massacre, for those who chose to return, some enjoyed a degree of success through sheer grit and hard work and a real drive to try and rebuild their lives. So they were facing incredible amounts of pushback from the white community in Tulsa. But some did rebuild, including Brenda's grandparents.
And even if we jump right forward, if we go beyond the 90s when there was at least an attempt to remember what had happened, if we fast forward 94 years all the way to 2015, you were writing about race relations in Tulsa again, weren't you? And not in a positive way. What happened?
In 2015, I was working on a project called The Counted, which was The Guardian's effort to document every single police killing in America, and came into contact with the Eric Harris case. So Eric Harris was a 44-year-old resident of Tulsa. And to me, it was one of the most horrific cases that I looked at that year. So Eric Harris was an unarmed African-American man who was shot dead by a reserve deputy with the Tulsa Sheriff's Office, a guy called Robert Bates, who was a white guy in his 70s. Essentially a volunteer police officer, and there were lots of allegations because Robert Bates had made significant donations to the sheriff's department that he was essentially a pay-to-play cop. And what happened was Eric was involved in an undercover sting, so he was caught allegedly selling an illegal firearm to an undercover officer, and Bates was involved in trying to apprehend him as he fled from the sting. And so as he was running away and as he was apprehended by officers that pinned him to the ground, Bates says that he accidentally opened fire on Eric Harris.
The video clearly shows mistakes made by 73-year-old Reserve Deputy Robert Bates. As the suspect is wrestled to the ground, Bates fires a gunshot, immediately apologizes, and drops the weapon. Bates told police he thought he was firing a taser, but why was Bates there to begin with?
And you can hear on the body camera video that documents this whole moment, Bates apologizing for shooting him. And shortly after Bates opened fire, you can hear Eric Harris saying that he is losing his breath. And the officer that is lying on top of him at that moment says to him, "Fuck your breath." Bates was ultimately tried and convicted of manslaughter, but only served a very, very short sentence and is now released and living in Florida.
And when you now see what's happened in the wake of George Floyd's death with a similar final sentiment, the idea that a black man was unable to breathe because of what the police were doing to him, it must feel even more chilling today. And in Tulsa, you went to see Andre Harris, Eric's brother.
Once you go through something like this, once you understand the system and see how it is.
Yeah, so I met Andre a couple of days before this rally is supposed to happen.
How many times have you watched that video of your brother dying?
Man, I watched that video, brother, probably 1,000 times. Probably 1,000 times. I wanted to hear his last words. So I could grab a hold of it, so that it could never be released.
After his brother died, Andre started researching the Tulsa massacre, and he saw these incredibly vivid and I would say completely accurate historic parallels.
Because it doesn't just stop with Eric Harris or George. This has been going on since the lynching of prominent businessmen here in 1921 in Oklahoma.
You know, as I mentioned, Eric was killed by a reserve deputy of the Tulsa Sheriff's Department. And a lot of the violence that occurred in 1921 was enacted at the hands of people conscripted by the sheriff's office to come in and suppress what they described as a riot, what we now know as a massacre.
When you go look at 1921 and you see everybody that gets their badge and get a chance to grab a gun and go, you know, shoot a brother, then you see the same thing in Bob Bates. Such disrespect for human life. Brother, I'm going for days.
So he spoke with great clarity and in vivid detail about the historic parallels that he saw between then and now.
1921 was supposed to be the first black city in Oklahoma and the most wealthiest in the country. Mm. But yet, when we did that and tried to have our own, guess what they did? They dropped bombs from the sky, baby.
So it's history repeating itself, generation upon generation, year upon year, really. The epidemic of police violence against communities of color did not go away after 2016 and the election of Donald Trump. It just lost some of the media oxygen because of Trump's presidency, I would say. And so really, I think what you're seeing with these protests that are going on in the wake of George Floyd is a continuation of a discussion that has been going on post-Ferguson, but really has been going on post-Tulsa in 1921, and really even before that as well.
So clearly, what happened in 1921 still reverberates today. And we're talking about a century later. But if we look beyond the kind of extreme mirror between what happened to Andre's brother and what happened then, the racist violence, you know, there are other problems facing the African-American community in Tulsa, aren't there? You walk through Greenwood District this week, 99 years after the massacre. What has changed for this community in Tulsa?
34% of the black population in Tulsa live in poverty, while only 13% of the white community live in poverty. The unemployment rate for black Tulsans is twice that for whites. Tulsa is a hyper-segregated city, so the majority of black residents in Tulsa live in the northern part of the city, which is poorer and much more over-policed. So black residents are 2.3 times more likely to be arrested than white residents. Some of those statistics come from a Human Rights Watch report that was published last year, which described the city as, quote, a case study in abusive, overly aggressive policing in America. And so really, the disparity exists across all areas of life, I would say, in the city. And that's also one of the things that Brenda told me.
I feel like we've come a long way over the years, for sure. But is there more work to be done? Yes, there is, because we're still talking about the same issues, it seems, that have been had for generations.
And really, that's not just a story of Tulsa. That exists in many, many major American cities. But I think, given the awful events of what have happened there, it's just incredibly pronounced in Tulsa.
The place that Trump is going to be holding his rally tomorrow is less than a mile from Greenwood District, where that massacre took place. Why do you think he chose this city?
I think it's difficult to answer why Donald Trump himself would have chosen that location. Donald Trump is not a student of history. He may well be one of those people who doesn't even know about the existence of the massacre in the first place. But his administration and his team absolutely do. And there's been a huge backlash since he announced the location that has given him ample opportunity to reconsider. But that's just not in his political mindset. So Senator Kamala Harris describe the decision to go to Tulsa as not just a wink to white supremacists, but throwing them a welcome home party. And, you know, really, Trump doesn't need to go to Oklahoma politically. Oklahoma hasn't elected a Democrat to the White House since 1968. It's a safe, secure, red state. And I guess in his defense, Trump has said, rhetorically that he cares deeply about the African-American community, and that he wants to share the work that he has done for minority communities during this rally. So I guess we're just going to kind of have to wait and see what tone he strikes. But really, just the fact that he's there has already led to so much outrage across the country that the damage has already been done.
So at the very, very least, you're saying that this was a thoughtless move, particularly in the wake of the Black Lives Matter protests. Is there any question that it's a move that they think could be good for them in vote terms? I know I'm sounding very, very cynical here, but we know that the president is advised by Stephen Miller, who is regularly described as a white nationalist.
Donald Trump thrives off divisiveness and controversy. And in no small part is that due to the advice that he is given by Stephen Miller, who, as you mentioned, is well documented to have white nationalist sympathies. There are reports that are unconfirmed at this stage that Miller is actually going to be writing his speech for the rally on Saturday. And I think, again, the damage has already been done, really. I think if Stephen Miller is writing this speech and if it is confirmed, that's going to be even more damage, irrespective of what he says. And what you have kind of seen when Trump tries to talk about race in America is he will talk about employment figures. He will talk about individual acts of pardon that he has done. And he will talk about tentative steps towards criminal justice reform. But he absolutely, categorically refuses to engage with the broader systemic issues that exist in American society and the issues that are really being articulated by activist groups like Black Lives Matter.
So you don't think he will engage directly with the outpouring in the wake of George Floyd's death?
I suspect that he may engage with it on his own terms. You know, he has spoken about George Floyd in the context of the jobs market. So when there was a positives jobs report last week, Trump said that George Floyd would have been very pleased about that.
Hopefully George is looking down right now and saying, there's a great thing that's happening for our country. There's a great day for him. It's a great day for everybody.
Which, again, was just seen as one of the most insensitive comments that he had made throughout this entire episode. With a man like Donald Trump and his ego, I see it as being almost impossible for him to articulate any sort of sentiment that is going to unify people in a way that perhaps past presidents have been able to do.
Coming up, it's not just the location or the date that makes Donald Trump's rally controversial. It's the fact that he's ready to pack 19,000 people into a hall in the middle of a pandemic. Ollie, this isn't just happening after the protest for Black Lives Matter. It's happening in the middle of a pandemic, which it is worth pointing out is disproportionately affecting African Americans in the US. I'm sorry if I'm being stupid here, but why in the middle of this pandemic is the president holding a rally? 19,000 people crammed into a hall doesn't sound like the best idea as COVID is still spreading.
It's absolutely not a stupid question at all. It's incredibly dangerous. And, you know, he's received widespread criticism by Democrats and actually by local public health officials in Tulsa as well.
A new warning this morning from Tulsa's health department director. Dr. Bruce Dart telling Tulsa World a large indoor rally with 19,000 to 20,000 people is a huge risk factor today in Tulsa, Oklahoma.
Who has said this is not the time to be holding mass indoor rallies. So Donald Trump is claiming that he's had a million people sign up to come to this event. Obviously, the stadium only holds 19,000 people. But everybody that's signed up and everybody that's going is already being made to sign a waiver to say that they won't hold the campaign responsible if they get COVID-19.
And you spoke to Mark Lotter, the director of strategic communications for Trump's campaign, about that waiver, didn't you?
Yeah, that's right.
For those who want to be here, that's your right.
I mean, if it is a right, why is the campaign asking people to sign waivers to not sue if they contract COVID-19? Is there not a disparity there?
That's just an acknowledgement of saying that we're providing you the information, you know the information, and we're letting you make those decisions for yourself.
But you are and you aren't, because you're withdrawing people's legal right to sue if they contract.
We are having people acknowledge that they know the risk and that they're taking that risk. And that in this country, we let people make those decisions for themselves.
And actually, what you're seeing in Oklahoma and many, many other states where Donald Trump is saying he's going to hold rallies is a surge and uptick in coronavirus cases in recent weeks. So Oklahoma is steadily getting around 200 new cases of coronavirus every day now. And that's actually above the levels that it was getting during the peak of the pandemic.
I can't get over the waiver or the fact that when you visited the arena, Trump's communications director told you people have been lining up for days to see him.
Just looking at it, it looks like we've got at least, 50 or 60 people here. I've heard some of them have been out here since Saturday, a week before the president arrives. And
given all the risks, why do you think Donald Trump feels he needs a rally at this time?
Donald Trump thrives on the attention. He thrives on the rallies. If you have been to a Trump rally, it is quite an extraordinary thing to go and see. You know, it's almost fever-like excitement when Trump comes on stage. He plays to the crowd. His supporters adore him.
We're looking forward to having the president here, and we're going to thank the people of Tulsa for the great hospitality. I just got here, but I can already tell that they're excited.
Yeah, we are.
And I think, you know, he's been without that for a few months and is probably craving the attention, to be frank. But Trump has a tendency to pick particular moments to inject himself into division and conflict and make things worse. When he was running for the presidency, I remember going to the city of Milwaukee in the state of Wisconsin very shortly after there had been an officer-involved death of a guy called Saville Smith.
New information tonight about the shooting death of Saville Smith.
That shooting by a Milwaukee police officer.
Who was a black guy who was shot from behind by a Milwaukee police officer, which led to a couple of days of sustained unrest. Donald Trump decided to go and hold a rally a few miles away from the site of where this unrest had occurred.
The violence, riots, and destruction that have taken place in Milwaukee is an assault on the right of all citizens to live in security and to live in peace.
I remember also going to a rally that he held in the town of Janesville in Wisconsin.
A live look from Janesville, where a Donald Trump rally was supposed to be.
Which was the site a few decades earlier of a major KKK rally. And he did that just after one of his rallies in Chicago had been shut down by protesters.
Tonight's rally will be postponed until another day. Thank you very much.
The first rally that Trump held after Charlottesville, which I'm sure everybody remembers, was the moment at which the anti-racist campaigner Heather Heyer was killed by a white supremacist terrorist off the back of racially motivated rioting by white supremacists in the city.
Torch-bearing white nationalists clashing with counter-protesters on the campus of the University of Virginia.
Things have changed.
Instead of holding a rally in a Trump stronghold, he went to the city of Phoenix, which is a blue city in the red state of Arizona, and held a rally there where he suggested he was going to pardon Joe Arpaio, who was an incredibly controversial sheriff in Arizona who targeted immigrant communities in Phoenix.
By the way, I'm just curious. Do the people in this room like Sheriff Joe?
So really, whether Trump knows of the historic significance of Tulsa, I think is almost irrelevant. He has an ability to go into controversial locations and essentially make things worse.
Presumably, it's also because Trump is quite worried. He has tanked in the opinion polls. He's looking at an election in November. He's obviously thinking about what he needs to do between now and then to have a chance to remain in the White House. How does the pandemic and the race uprising affect things in his eyes?
I suspect that this is also an attempt for him to try and regain the narrative, to present himself again as a strong president who's in control of the country, who's not bothered by public health risks, who will show a strong face in, you know, the face of what is expected to be more protests on the ground in Tulsa against him being there. I think it also lays the gauntlet down to Joe Biden, who is obviously his opponent in the upcoming election. Biden has been incredibly cautious, followed CDC guidance and other public health guidance not to hold rallies, to appear in public with a mask, which Donald Trump is not doing, and to hold his events via Zoom and that sort of thing. Much of the base of Donald Trump have been those who are sort of out in public refusing to wear masks, who see wearing masks as a weakness and that sort of thing. And I think that the decision to hold this rally now is an attempt to show strength, to, you know, to show machismo and to try and challenge Joe Biden to see what he'll do next.
Next year will mark 100 years since that massacre in Tulsa that was so devastating, not just in terms of lives lost and in a really brutal manner, but also in terms of crushing the progress for African Americans. It feels from a lot of what you said that so little progress has been made over that century. How important is 2020 for the future of this community in the US?
So President Obama has famously said that the US can endure 4 years of Donald Trump, but 8 years may well lead to irreversible change. And, you know, I've certainly covered some of the most extreme moments of the Trump presidency from the ground. So I was at the southern border during child separation, looked at the consequences of deregulation of the Environmental Protection Agency, and have been doing coverage of COVID-19 as well. And really, those are just a few examples of the extreme policy decisions that have been made by this administration and just the rhetoric of the president himself that have had really adverse effects on communities of colour all around this country. And I suspect if Trump is allowed to have four more years in power, winning re-election and the authority that that will give him, I can only imagine it will be worse.
Ollie, thank you very much.
Thanks so much, Anushka.
That's it for today. My thanks to Oliver Lachland. Follow his coverage of tomorrow's rally in Tulsa at theguardian.com. This episode was produced by Mithali Rao. Sound design was by Nicholas Cox. The executive producers are Nicole Jackson and Phil Maynard. Have a lovely weekend, and we'll be back on Monday.